Parsha, and we'll begin with a story. This story happened numerous times in our house with numerous kids. I'd make lunches for the kids, and then I'd get a complaint. Kid would come home and say, "Abba, you made me peanut butter." And I'd say, "Yeah." And they'd say, "I wanted jelly." So, okay. The next day they'd come home and complain and say, "Abba, you made me jelly." I'd say, "Right." And they'd say, "I wanted peanut butter." I'd say, "Okay." So the next morning I asked the kid, "What do you want?" And the kid says, "Peanut butter." So I make peanut butter. And the kid goes, "Well, actually, I want jelly." So I go, "Okay, but you said peanut butter." So the kid goes, "But now I want jelly." So what do you do? So what I did was I'd make the sandwich and then ask the kid, "What do you want?" And the kid would go, "What'd you make me?" And I'd say, "Peanut butter." And they'd say, "Well, I wanted jelly." And I'd say, "Okay, it's actually jelly." And the kid would go, "Well, actually, I want peanut butter." And I'd say, "Okay, actually, it's peanut butter." And the kid would go, "Well, which one is it?" And I'd say, "Well, which one did you want?" And the kid would look at me and say, "What do you mean?" I'd say, "Didn't you notice that whatever I said, you said the other way?" And the kid doesn't notice it. And the kid goes, "No." And I'd say, "Okay, fine. So tell me, what do you want?" So, and they'd say, "But what do you have in there?" And I'd say, "What difference does it make? You don't know, right? What do you want? What do you want?" And suddenly the kid has to face the reality, which children don't even notice, that what they want is to complain. People don't notice this about themselves. We don't notice that we're looking for what to complain about. And what happened here, and again, when it happened with the first kid, so I thought, wow. And then I saw it with the second kid, I said, it must be my family. By the time I saw it with the third kid, I said, okay, this is the way kids are, fine. I came to a realization that there's a stage where kids want to complain. It's part of a child's finding identity. If I can say what you did, I'm not happy with, so I exist. I'm not just an extension of you. I can critique you. So if I'm critiquing, I exist. So I can say I'm not happy with what you did. Okay. The problem is when we as adults do that, and we do, sometimes we look for what to complain about. That's where it becomes dangerous. And the pasuk says, "Vayhi ha'am kemitonanim," and because Ben thinks I'm being harsh with Klal Yisrael, I'm going to quote Rashi: "En mitonanim ela leshon alila." Mitonanim is where a person's looking for cause. Mevakshim alila ech lifrosh ma'achrei ha'makom. Let's find a claim to pull away from Hashem. And here we have insight that the Gemara expands. The Gemara says that there's one mitzvah that we usually have an issue with. There's one thing that really bothers us about Torah. It's a strong point of the Jewish people, but it's a weakness of the Jewish people. It is the mitzvot of interrelations between men and women. When the Torah limits me in my ability to have relations with women, when the Torah tells me I have to lead a holy lifestyle, when the Torah tells me how to lead that lifestyle, when the Torah tells me I cannot be promiscuous, so then everything else in the Torah is doable, and that one area of Torah becomes a difficulty. And so our sages worded it very acutely. Our sages said, even when the Jewish people went after paganism, they only did it as an excuse so they'd have an out to do what they wanted. Rambam says that every philosopher's argument against Judaism stemmed from the desire for promiscuity. Meaning, if the Torah wouldn't limit me with regards to women, then everything else about the Torah we'd be fine with. That's one area where a person has such tremendous desire that it's very hard for him. And so it clouds his vision about everything else, because it's an area where he doesn't want to buy into it, because if I buy into it, then it limits me, then I'm obligated. Just a minute, wait. In Eishet Torah, they had a program where people who were non-observant could show up to the program. and they had an ingenious intro to the program. Before you came to the program, in order to attend, you had to sign a piece of paper that said you would not accept upon yourself any mitzvot for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, for a period of time, I don't know the exact period of time, after attending the program. Let's say a month. For a month after attending the program, you may not accept upon yourself any mitzvot. If you agree to that, you can attend the program. Why is that ingenious?
That's psychology.
No, it's allowing me to analyze things without letting my personal biases interfere. Let's analyze whether it's true or not, whether I should do it or not. What the outcome would be should be irrelevant. I don't think it's sneaky, I think it's real. You know, I had a question a month ago, and I couldn't decide what the answer was. And I asked my wife, what do you think? And my wife said to me, it would sound like a very simple line, my wife said to me, if someone else asked you the question, what would you say? So I thought I'd have an easy answer. I thought I'd tell my wife I'm stumped. I thought I'd tell her, I might tell the person, I don't know. I thought for a minute and I said, I'd tell him, cut the nonsense and go do X. So my wife said, then cut the nonsense and go do X. I couldn't, when I was a factor, I was partial. Right? That's different. There, he didn't even know it was about him. He was asked the question. He didn't know it was about him. Here, what was surprising to me was that I was able to zone out of myself for a minute. I knew the question was relevant to me. I can tell you what the question was. It's not such a big deal. But the second I pulled myself out of the equation, I was able to see through the answer. So it's coming back. I'm telling you how I applied it practically. Real life.
You can't do that to yourself.
You're saying I needed someone else to ask me what I would say?
That, you need someone else to.
Really? I don't know. I didn't think of that. So get a good friend. What can I tell you? I didn't think that was the key. I thought it was just saying that. So coming back to our parasha, Am Yisrael was looking for what to complain about. So they're complaining, and they say, we've been traveling so fast, so hard, so quick, and our sages say there was nothing to complain about. They were heading towards the best possible gift. It's like a guy saying he's heading towards his wife, and he's complaining. It's a very fast trip. You want to get there as soon as possible. There was no reason to complain. The real reason was they were looking for what to complain about as an excuse to absolve themselves of their responsibilities to Hashem. And that, we encounter that when we wake up Shabbos morning and we don't feel like getting out of bed and going to shul. Maybe you guys never have this. Some people have this, that they get up in the morning and they don't want to go, and they're looking for an excuse. So they're going to say something. Because I don't want to say I'm lazy. I don't want to say I just feel like staying in this comfortable bed. So we look for an excuse that's... So Am Yisrael looks for what to complain against Hashem. And a fire breaks out, and it's recognized as a fire from Hashem, and people start dying. And here we have two opinions as to who were dropping from the fire. One opinion says it was the Erev Rav. They were the troublemakers to begin with. There were 2 million people who wanted to join the Jewish people when they left Egypt. And Moshe approved, and he didn't ask Hashem. And they brought on all kinds of problems, including these complaints. So that's one opinion. The other opinion says, the other opinion says that the fire hit specifically the leaders, that it was the officers who were the problematic ones or that needed to be hit in this. So that's the second opinion here. When it says the edge of the camp, does it mean to denote the upper edge, the leadership, or it means the the outer edge, the Erev Rav? Okay, the nation turns to Moshe, and Moshe prays, and the fire sinks into the ground. Then we have, again, the Erev Rav. They start complaining, we miss all the meat. They complain, we remember the fish we had for free in Egypt. This is interesting, the fish is called meat. We don't wait from fish, we eat fish and milk. No one's Sfaradi here, right? No Sfaradi here? Oh, so some Sfaradim don't eat fish and milk together. But the rest of us do. It's interesting, you know, in Israel, Sfaradim outnumber Ashkenazim. It's only in this class that I could say it that way. The Sephardim in Israel statistically outnumber the Ashkenazim, always. They said, we remember the Kishuim. What are Kishuim? Kishuim are probably melons.
They didn't have this.
I don't know.
Are they lying?
They didn't have melons?
No, they didn't get all this amazing stuff for free in Egypt. Brett Matzahs, no?
So there were two classes of Jews in Egypt. There were Jews who were upper class, who were close to Pharaoh, and that's why you find that God has to pass over the house of the Jews, because there were Jews who lived with the aristocracy of Egypt. Then you had Jews who were the slaves. You had both.
How is that possible? How did we let that happen?
Well, you see it from the Torah. Moshe comes to two Jews fighting, and one Jew can go to Pharaoh and report him. How was he able to go to Pharaoh and report him? He had access to Pharaoh. How did he do that? There are other indications of it. They remember all the different foods they had in Egypt for free. And now they're only eating man all this time. It's been a year and a half, and all they're eating is man. So again, Chazal say this was not really a based claim. It was looking for excuses to complain. And Moshe was upset. So he says to Hashem, why'd you do this to me? I can't handle this nation. I can't do this. Where could I feed them all this meat? I can't handle it alone. And better you let me die, because I can't handle these people. So what we see here is a statistical reality. Almost always, we will break at the point where if we'd hold on a little bit longer, things would be much better. How many times were you waiting at the bus stop or at the train stop, and you walked away and you were just far enough away that you missed the bus, and you walked away when the bus came? So you tell yourself, I'm going to walk away and the bus will come, and you stay and the bus doesn't come. Right? Did you ever do that? And then, when you actually do walk away, then it comes. And usually, just when you're far enough away that you missed it. How come? How come is it that most people buy a stock when it's high, just before it's about to go down, and they sell it when it's low, just before it's about to go back up? How come? How come most people lose at the stock market? Why? What? I didn't hear you. Murphy's Law. No, there's a reason behind it. There's a reason. It's not. That's part of it, but there's also a statistical reality.
Things predict stuff.
Why?
These things don't happen because we did them. We can't predict that.
I didn't say it happened because. That's what I said.
It always happens, but it's not.
The cause and the effect are not interrelated. The non-interrelated in the way that. Because I did it, it happened. It's not because you leave the stop, the bus will come. But if you want to see a good indicator of whether the bus will come, wait till other people leave. Wait. Then it makes sense to wait a little bit longer. The idea is like this. We tend to break just before we should. We have this tendency in almost everything. You'll find it in your marriage as well. That if you make up a date with your wife, usually either the day or the hour before the date, things become tremendously tense to the point where you might actually not go on that date. Right before Shabbos, things become very tense in the house. Why? Things are, you see it all the time, that people reach the point where if they only cross that hurdle, they'll be okay. Am Yisrael is standing a few days away from Israel. They made it this far. They made it through all the slavery of Egypt. They made it through the Exodus. They made it through Sinai. And now they're on the way. They're almost there. And they're going to ruin it.
Did you know it's 3 days?
Yes. They know they're a mere day, few days journey away from Israel. They know that. Let's send spies. We have a tendency to destroy things. You know how many times I've seen people on the verge of getting engaged ruin it for themselves, destroy the shidduch? I've seen people literally the day of their engagement destroy their engagement. Because let me make sure the guy knows how bad I am. He doesn't really know me. Let me make sure the girl knows how bad I am. She doesn't really know me. She doesn't know that aspect of me. There are all kinds of things that people do that destroy things when it's just about to succeed. in every area of their life. So Moshe Rabbeinu says at this point, kill me. I can't deal. So Hashem says, no, we'll appoint 70 elders. And they'll be there with you, and I will give them prophetic vision with you. Yeah?
I heard that's why Moshe died in the desert.
Okay.
He died. Any weight?
For hitting the rock.
I'm saying it, Atnayev Atzadik, Atnayev Atzadik will work even without the conditions.
Okay. Okay. I don't remember such a medrash, but I'll take your word for it.
So Eldad and Medad are mentioned here.
We'll get to them, right?
Decided not.
So Hashem says we will appoint 70 elders. How deep do you guys want to go? So there's a lot to discuss here. I'm listening. Right. What does that indicate, though? I'm not saying you'll never show up when the bus comes. I'm not saying you'll always show up when the bus isn't there. I'm saying but the times that you show up and you wait and you wait and you wait, so it's very common that when you break is just before it's about to get better. And it's the same thing with the stock market. Ask anyone that's been in the stock market. The time that they break is almost always when they shouldn't. I'm not saying everyone. No statistic is 100%. We're talking about is there such a trend? Can you see such a trend? Look around you. You'll see it. You'll see it in every area of life. It's not just in the stock market. I've seen people being two semesters away from getting their degree and dropping out of medical school. I didn't think that could happen. You know, a person went through 7 years, right? Yeah. And now, in the last two semesters, dropping out. I've seen that too. Again, it's not everyone. For most people, they're going to overcome it. But it's fairly common that we reach certain finish lines, and that's where we conk out, just before the finish line. It's a common trend.
Very easily said.
There are different tools. There are different tools. I'll give an example. Rashi writes, this is how he interprets a Gemara, that if you want an amulet not to finish something, tell yourself, I will try to finish by this date. If you say, I will try to finish this tractate by this date, almost definitely you won't succeed. So I always thought that Rashi was the way, when I found that it worked for me, was when I didn't say, I want to finish this tractate, I'd say, I want to review the tractate 3 times. I will finish the first time here. It's part of a course. I don't end here. And that's based on a concept they taught us in Taekwondo. In martial arts, when you're trying to break a table or a brick, so they tell you the way to break it is when you come down with your karate chop, you can't imagine the point of contact with the table. You have to imagine yourself here, a foot under the table. You have to, your motion has to be that you're going straight through the table, and your force is not at the table. Your force is at 6 inches beneath the table. That's where your force is focused at. If you're focused at here, on the table, you're not going to break it. If your focus is after, right. If your focus is after the table, then you go straight through the table. So that's what I'm saying. I think it's this. Could I show you? But it's not my table.
Oh.
Bring one of your tables, right? I'll tell you the truth, I'm out of practice. But
don't mess.
Sounds good. But coming back to here, so I think that's also when you say how do people overcome it, if my goal is still here, then I have a challenge when I reach here. If my goal is onward and this is just a step along the way, the focus has to be beyond the goal. That's when I think people find that they can go there. Back to our parsha. So Moshe Rabbeinu, the Jewish people, everyone's hit a downturn. Hashem says appoint 70 elders. There is a long speech which we learned by the Ran discussing, does Judaism promote democracy? The Ran, who was chief rabbi 750 years ago, wrote a speech about what form of government does Judaism actually promote? What does the Torah want you to have?
Not a fully democratic thing, but we do have a lot of democratic stuff.
Oh, so the Ran writes something which we see today, that democracy has a weakness that it can be its own undoing. In democracy is a system created really to protect the individual's rights, but it does not ensure the best process of government. The reason we do a democracy is I want to make sure that all the individual's rights are protected. But is it the best way for a government to function? For sure not. How did Rome fall? If we have to decide whether to go to war, and in order to decide, I have to convene a Senate, and everyone has to take a vote, we have a problem. There are many. The truth is that a good ruler is going to be better than a democracy. A democracy is a system that ensures protection of the individual's rights from the tyrant, from the evil ruler. But in essence, the best system is one with a benevolent ruler, because then he can factor in everyone's needs, and he can appoint people to verify and to decide where necessary, and he has the power to make things happen the way they should. So it's the most efficient and best system. The problem is that whenever you had monarchies, they became the evil monarch. They became the tyrant. If you can maintain the kind, benevolent monarch, then it's a good system. When Moshe was told to have 70 people, says the Ran, the concern was you'd have 71 opinions. Moshe and 70 other people. That's what they say about the Jewish state. The United States has how many people? No, how many people? How many citizens in the United States?
4 million, I think.
How many parties? 2. The state of Israel has how many people? How many parties?
Oh, 20-something.
20-something, right? How come? What? A lot. How come?
It's the system.
Okay.
Well, everyone wants different things, and they want to do it themselves. They don't want to unite.
So the concern was with just in the religious parties. How many religious parties do you have? You think we all want the same thing, right? So So the concern was with 70 people that you'd have 70 opinions. So here we learn another few new concepts. Number one, they all got their prophecy through Moshe. It was a different type of prophecy. Hashem says, you stand next to them, it'll overflow from you. Number two, who invented the first camera? Who invented the first camera? Mr. Kodak? No, Mr. Eastman. There were two people simultaneously working on the same idea. One was called Eastman, one was called Kodak. Eastman developed his first, and then he sued Kodak after Kodak went with his first. We find... No, Kodak lost. In the court case, if I remember correctly, Kodak lost. In the world, we find that when things come down to the world, they don't only come down to one person. They come down and they separate. The same ideas in prophecy, says the Ran. That if a person's a prophet and he's standing here and someone else is standing next to him, even if that person is not necessarily worthy of prophecy, he might get prophecy just because he's standing next to him. It's like it overflows. So Hashem says, take the 70 people, they'll stand with you and they'll get prophecy. They'll get your prophecy. It'll be a united front leading the Jewish people. And then you have two people who are not with Moshe. You have two people who are in the camp, these youngsters who are Moshe's half-brothers, Eldad and Medad, are walking around saying that Moshe's going to die, Yeshua's going to lead the Jewish people, and they're breaking ranks. The whole idea was these prophets would all be students of Moshe, they'd work with Moshe, and you have two people in the camp, they're prophesizing, and they're saying a totally different prophecy. So Yeshua, who hears the prophecy that his Rebbe's going to die and he's going to be the next leader, runs out to Moshe and says, Moshe, you got to lock him up. These guys are prophesizing inside the camp. And what does Moshe in his humility say? Umi yiten. I wish it could be that everyone were prophets. Don't worry. Don't be jealous on my behalf. It's good. The more, the better. This is one of the rules that Rambam writes when we want to see if a machloket is l'shem shamayim, or two people arguing for the sake of heaven. What's my opinion of the other one? What do I want? Am I looking to prove I'm right? Or am I happy if he's right too? In Talmud, you'll see often that the rabbis bring proofs to the one they're arguing against. They say, no, let me show you why you're right, because the goal is the truth. We reach the story of the Slav. So we have this fish bird that's very fatty. It's a fish that comes from the sea, that hovers over the sea. It's got wings. It flies out to the camp. It's really a fish. And it is so fatty that, yeah, you're a Yemenite. You should know. It's a Yemenite medrash. And the medrash Ma'ora Feilah. That's what he writes. He gives you the Arabic name so you could look it up. Right, exactly. So look it up. In the Ma'ora Feilah, he brings the name of the fish, what the slav is. The Gemara in Tractate Yuma speaks about a bird. He says it's a fish bird. look it up. So the Gemara says you could fill 13 loaves of bread with the fats of the slav. So they would hover at arm's length and people would grab them and they'd have lunch. So people die from eating them because they eat too much. They're gobbling it down. I don't know. He's going to tell us the Arabic name. Maybe he'll tell us. I don't know. And we reach the end of the parasha. And at the end of the parasha, we have a fantastic, complicated, almost impossible to understand story. And we have many different interpretations as to what happens at the end of the parasha. We'll begin with Rashi's interpretation. That's classical. Do you guys all know Rashi? Can I go on to the other commentaries? Or should we start with Rashi? Do we know Rashi? No. So let's do Rashi. Okay? Our first baseline is always Rashi. So Moshe married a very pious woman. Her name was Tzipporah. And Tzipporah came out to the camp with Moshe's children. And Tzipporah was an extraordinary lady. It says she was like singled out in her generation for her piety. And after Moshe saw that he was getting prophecy without warning, every second Hashem could talk to him, so he realized he has to maintain a level of purity. And when a person emits their seed, be it with their wife or not with their wife, they become defiled, they become tamei, they have to go to mikvah, and then they become pure that night. Moshe realizes that if he continues being intimate with his wife, so then it would interfere with his duties. He's not supposed to do that. So he infers, after his 40 days in heaven, again and again, that Hashem talks to him on such a level that his skin is shining. He spent 40 days not eating or drinking. He understands he's not supposed to go back to intimacy in this world. And Hashem already told him that when he saw the burning bush. You remember what were the first things Hashem told him? Moshe, Moshe, shal na'alecha me'al raglecha. What does that mean?
Take your shoes off.
Right. So in Kabbalistic terms, you want deep stuff. In Kabbalistic terms, the shoe is what you stand on your whole life. The body is the shoe for the soul. Just like the shoe is what the body stands on, so the body is called the shoe of the soul.
But you have a duty in this life also. You're not this.
Let's first understand what we're learning and then see questions. Let's first hear it. I'm saying, so Moshe is told, remove your shoes from your feet. He understands he's supposed to separate. Now we have a little bit of insight into the mitzvah of chalitza. You guys learned about chalitza? Yeah? Chalitza, if a man dies without children, then his wife can marry his brother, even though a woman is biblically prohibited from marrying her brother-in-law. But if he dies without children, then there's a mitzvah, a unique thing. The sister-in-law is supposed to marry her brother-in-law. And then the Torah says, what happens if the brother-in-law says, I don't want to do it? So then she takes off his shoe and spits in it. What's she saying? You don't want to give a body to your brother's soul. Your brother's soul would have representation in this world if you would marry me and have kids. You're not willing to do that. So she takes off the shoe. That's a representation of this idea, because you're not giving a body to the soul. Coming back to here. So when these 70 men get prophecy through Moshe, Tzipporah standing out there next to Miriam. And she says to Miriam, I feel bad for their wives. So Miriam says, why? So Tzipora says, well, I guess just like Moshe put his bed on the other side of the tent and basically divorced me. We live in the same tent, but he's on the other side of the tent when he comes home to sleep. Their husbands are going to do the same now. So Miriam says, really? And she runs over to Aaron, and she has good intentions. She's concerned for her brother's marriage. Sounds legitimate, right? So she runs to Aaron. Aaron is the big brother. And she says, Aaron, I've been a prophetess since I was 5 years old. You've had prophecy since before Moshe became the leader of the Jewish people. Have you separated from your wife? Aaron says, no. Miriam says, neither have I. I've maintained the regular life with my husband. And then they say a line that they were not allowed to say. So Hashem spoke to Moshe just like Hashem spoke to us. Why did he do it? That sentence, Hashem spoke to Moshe like Hashem spoke to us, they weren't allowed to say. That was Lashon Hara. To cross that line and think that they know Moshe's prophecy and it equals theirs, that was prohibited. And to my mind, this is the hardest parsha in the whole Torah. I personally have the hardest time. If you ask me in the whole Torah, what's the hardest parsha? It's right here. Because the Torah is really telling me I have to be so sensitive when I talk about my brother. But I have good intentions. I'm talking about his marriage. They were concerned for Moshe's marriage. They had just heard there's a problem there. They separated their beds for the last year and a half. Weren't they legitimate in being concerned? They had to be a little bit more sensitive in how they spoke about Moshe. So that sensitivity, to my mind, is probably the hardest mitzvah. I think this is really the hardest thing in the whole Torah. When we are taught to be that sensitive when we speak about someone else. So what does Hashem do? Hashem appears suddenly without warning to Aaron and Miriam. Aaron and Miriam had just been intimate with their spouse a day or two ago and they hadn't yet gone to mikvah. So Aaron and Miriam are both getting a spiritual elevation when they're not physically fit for it. They both feel like their skin is jumping off of them. Their skin breaks out. They both turn into leprosy. Their skin is in pain. They both feel like they're suffering all over their whole body. Both Aaron and Miriam start yelling, Ribon Shalom, we can't handle this. Ribon Shalom, we need to go to the mikvah. We can't. And Hashem says, let's talk. And now Aaron and Miriam are invited outside the camp. At the same moment, Hashem invites Moshe. And Hashem purposely does it suddenly, the same moment they spoke. Hashem doesn't want time to pass so that they won't think that Moshe got wind of what they said and he complained to Hashem. Hashem does it right away. They don't have room to think anything happened. Boom. They're both covered with tzaras and they both say, God, we can't do this. Ribon Shel Olam, we're in pain. We can't. And Hashem says, Shimuna Devarai, could you listen? I want to tell you something, please. Im yeh neviachem, if there'll be any other prophet other than Moshe, Hashem, b'mara elav etvada, I appear to him through a vision. You guys, when you talk to me, we don't talk the same way as Moshe. Lo chen avdi Moshe. My servant Moshe, he's not like that. Pel peh adaber bo, I speak directly with his mouth. You guys see visions. You don't hear direct words from me. You get messages. You see visions. You see angels. I talk to Moshe on a level you never get spoken to. And I told him to leave his wife. And if he would have been my servant and he wouldn't have been Moshe, you should have been scared to talk about your little brother that way. If he would have been Moshe, such a tzaddik, and he wasn't my servant, you should have been scared. Moshe is the most humble man. When Hashem told Moshe to write this in the Torah, Moshe was hesitant. So he wrote the words, Va'ish Moshe Anav, should be written, Ayin Nun Yud Vav. So Moshe was like, I could leave out the Yud. It'll read like Anu Me'od. It'll be not so clear that I'm so humble. So he wrote Ayin Nun Vav, like he forgot the Yud. So God says, Moshe, you left out the Yud. Okay, don't fix it. Just add the word Me'od. Make it very. Right? So now Moshe had to write Anav Me'od. More than any other human in his generation. Our sages say, you want to understand Moshe's humility? Wait till the next time you're on a bus and a guy walks on the bus and he's covered with boils, and he has this foul smell, and he's wearing rags, and he's dripping pus, and everyone on the bus does this. Right? Everyone's scared of getting his disease, so they walk away, and they try not to talk to him. It's common sense. The question is, what does that person feel like? If every place he goes, no one dares talk to him. We had a rabbi here once who had a disease that he wasn't allowed to get germs. But I didn't know that. So he used to come to yeshiva with a face mask on, like a surgeon's mask. And the reason was to protect his lungs. But the guys who saw him every day knew that. I didn't know that. So when I'd come to yeshiva and I saw him with the mask on, I'd like to stay really far away. I was scared. What does he have that's contagious that he's walking around with a mask, right? Imagine a person that spends his life with people staying really far from him. How does that person feel? He feels like all of society puts him down. How does he feel about himself? So he probably feels very, very down. Chazal say Moshe felt less than that. If you want to know how low Moshe felt, it says there are 13 types of boils that a person can have. Moshe felt less than the worst one, the worst type of boils a person can have. Moshe is the top man in world history, and he is so humble he doesn't see himself that way. He is so lowly. So Moshe is not fighting his siblings. And so when the story's over, Hashem expresses his anger to the two of them, being that Miriam instigated the conversation and Aaron still has to be the Kohen Gadol. Aaron's teras leaves and everything stays with Miriam. Aaron begs Moshe, please pray for her. And Moshe asks Hashem, Kel, the powerful one, no, please, refa, cure, no, now, la, her. You knew the word na has two meanings. The word na can mean please. The word na can mean now. Sometimes it means this, sometimes it means that. It has a third meaning. Does anyone know what na, third meaning for the word na mean? Na could also mean raw. It's probably from the word now. You're eating it now, raw. Okay.
Can I ask a question?
We have a lot to cover. Yes, sir.
Why would God have him marry her?
Not marry her. Why would he have them stay together in the same tent if she loses this the intimacy?
It's a great question. Let's pick up with it in 5 minutes. I don't want to miss our pizza order. Let me order pizza. We'll start with your question, okay?
Okay.